Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us, as always, here on The Avid Reader. And thanks for supporting the bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop, where Lee Durkee's book, The Last Taxi Driver, sits there both in paperback and in hardback. Lee's first novel was Rise of the Midway back in 2001. His stories and essays have appeared in Harper's, Tin House, Alas No More, and Best of the Oxford American, among many others. And in a few months, his latest memoir, Stalking Shakespeare, will chronicle his decade-long obsession with trying to find lost portraits of William Shakespeare. He is a former cab driver, like our protagonist, Lou, and he lives in North Mississippi. So The Last Taxi Driver kind of makes us all Dantes being led by Virgil through the nine circles of hell. And Lou, our protagonist, and I made up this metaphor before I read it in the book, so now I feel like I didn't get credit for it. He's our Charon, ferrying his passengers across the River Styx with a can of Red Bull as his own personal Cerberus. But my rule is when my metaphors become ludicrous, I stop to introduce the author. So, and this all happens within the tattered and befouled 20-year-old broken dick Lincoln Town Car. So welcome, Lee, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Hey, so is it just a ride? Is that what it is?
I think it is just a ride. That's what Bill Hicks said, and sometimes I think he's right. It's certainly not a bad way to approach life at times.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it makes things a lot easier if you think it's all an illusion.
Yes, I suppose if you put it that way, it doesn't sound so wise. But if you approach it as Hicks did, I think, as an experience that maybe the stakes aren't as high as we think they are, that it's something more playful, that there is a playfulness to life that maybe we should concentrate on instead of the direness of it all the time, that perhaps gives you a patience to carry through during bad times. Or that's my theory. Or that was Bill Hicks' theory.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you got that great blurb by George Saunders, and I interviewed him for 10th of December. It kind of depressed me. And I said to him, so George, you know, I'm kind of depressed, like I need therapy or something after reading your book. I mean, what's going to happen to me? And he goes, well, you're going to get sick and then you're going to die.
There you go.
Yeah. And I said, thanks a lot. That's a nice way to end the interview.
Yeah. Well, if you ask a Buddhist a question, you get a Buddhist reply, I guess. I remember when George first got into Buddhism, I think for the first year or two, he was taught to meditate on death. So I'm sure that was the quick reply for him.
I know, it just didn't make me feel great. Because I'm already a hypochondriac too. But anyway, so yeah, what I was thinking about was I've been interviewing all these like biologists and quantum physicists, and I always ask them the same thing. What if it's just a solipsistic universe? And they always get pissed off because that would mean we're not actually there. It's not an interview. Just one of us is thinking it, but I don't know which one. And they always get pissed off because it screws up their whole theory. And that also reminds me a little bit of the book. I don't know why.
Oh, there's a lot of solipsism in everything I write, I think. I suffer from that as a condition. Solipsism haunts me. The idea that I might actually be the center of the universe, having created everything around me, which is a very tantric point of view. In Tantra, we're seen as projectors. Everybody is a projector and is creating the environment in front of us, which is semi-solipsistic, I would say.
Somebody, yeah, every time we perceive projection, we're just assuming that somebody's got this thing going on within their own wetware that we are interpreting. I remember when I was a little kid, I thought when I went to sleep, my parents took the universe apart because there wasn't any reason for it to exist while I was sleeping. And then the morning before I woke up, they like really hurriedly put everything back together again.
Wow, you had it bad, huh? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's still late. Yes. It still lingers. So you know, I'm just babbling, and stop me when I do that because we're trying to sell your book. So let's talk about Lou's job so we can set it up for not only our listeners, but when I'm hand selling the book at the store.
Okay. Lou's a day shift cabbie, and that's an important distinction with the book, because having driven night shift and day shift involves a lot more responsibility and there's a lot more pressure. You're picking regulars up and you're trying to get them to work on time. And if you don't get them to work on time, they can get fired. Usually, in my case, we were picking them up from the projects and trailer homes surrounding this affluent college town. And it was a strenuous job, especially if you have a dispatcher who isn't on point and you're backed up five or six rides. And these are your friends you're giving a ride to. They're your regulars. And you know the consequences if they're late. So day shift cabbie is like a utility. It's a very important part of the community. And I took a lot of pride in it. I enjoyed the job. It didn't pay well. The hours were horrible, 70 hours a week sometimes. But I really felt as if I were contributing to the community in a way that I really didn't feel when I was teaching English 101 to freshmen at Ole Miss, University of Mississippi. So I liked the job, and I think I'm about to go back and do it some more.
Yeah, well, that leads me into, since you alluded to it, to Stella, where I could go into another Greek or Italian metaphor, but I won't. So let's talk about Stella, because she's the bane of Lou's existence. But much like, I don't know, in Kill Bill, where one of the guys goes and cleans the toilets and all that, and he says, she deserves to kill us. It's like, he puts up with Stella. He puts up with everything she does. So who is she and why does he do that?
Well, she started the taxi company, which is the oldest in the town, you know, decades earlier. She's eccentric. She has a pill problem. She has a drinking problem. And she's a dispatcher. And that's a bad combination. So she's the one in charge of organizing Lou's rides. And that can just make you very miserable. But she's also one of those people who treats her employees as if they're her therapist. So Lou has to deal with her phone calls all the time. And she's a bit too honest in those phone calls. But to get back to your original point, I think Lou admires her begrudgingly because he understands how much her cab company has contributed to the town, the lives it saved by getting drunks home, et cetera. And you just admire anybody that can run a small business for 20, 30 years. It's not an easy thing to do. So I hope that admiration came through, as well as, of course, the satire, et cetera, the comedy centered around her character.
Well, that's the whole thing about the book, is there's all these juxtapositions. Like if you go to Moondog, for God's sakes, you know, it's like, I didn't expect them to be like that, but we'll get to him. But so what about Stella's kid, Tony? Because there's so many characters and they're all so well drawn, I can't go through all of them, but I like some of them more than others. So
yeah, well, I'm sure you didn't like Tony much, but I tried to give Tony, at least he was an unsavory character, not much to redeem him, except he's a romantic at heart. And in the end, you know, he's sort of a hero. So what I tried to do in the book was show Lou's prejudices towards each and every character, and then have Lou understand that all his preconceptions about these people were wrong. Everybody gets a little bit of redemption, and Lou, which really depresses Lou because it kind of brings him down in the tier of life, and he's kind of like, they're all better than me. But I wanted to redeem the characters that Lou was too judgmental of at first, and that was one of the things I tried to do, especially towards the end of the book, and with Tony specifically.
I like the way Lou diagnoses himself with, you know, borderline personality, schizophrenia, manic depression, OCD, because I've gotten those diagnoses from the DSM-5, all of them. And, you know, it's like, okay, they put the number down so they can prescribe whatever medication they need to prescribe to me.
Yeah, well, we all self-diagnose. And what's been kind of funny is that, I don't know if it's funny or not, but these maladies that I've attached to Lou are assumed to be also part of me. And I'll read an article or a review and, you know, Lee Durkee, an author suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. And I'm like, well, Not really, but okay. If it sells books, I'll have paranoid schizophrenia.
Well, you did. You have said it's. You have said it a couple of times. It's a lot. He's a lot like. You have said something like he's a lot like me, or I draw from him, or something. Or, you know, he is part of you. So obviously he is. I mean, it couldn't happen.
Yeah, guilty as charged. Right. I don't have a great imagination where I can concoct other worlds, other settings, other people. I draw on life, always have. I usually start off with memoir and then turn it into a novel. I think that's the way I'm going to continue to write.
The other people, the other thing that reviewers like to say, they like to go, and it's been 20 years since his last novel. And I was like, okay, well, what do you mean by that actually?
Yeah, that really, I think in the attempt to sell books, people are really anxious to hop on any narrative you can give them. So that, the fact that I was a cab driver and the fact that I hadn't published a book in 20 years and was, of course, a paranoid schizophrenic, apparently, was the narrative that got attached. And it did get a bit overplayed, but 20 years actually is a pretty depressingly long time to go without publishing a book.
Yeah, which is the same thing, once again, goes to Lou. I mean, Lou is all these things. He's an author who published a book, and he's a cab driver.
Exactly.
And a teacher. Have you been a teacher?
Yeah, I taught at Ole Miss for a couple of semesters. Was pretty miserable at it because I'm not overly fond of the student body at Ole Miss. I was raised in South Mississippi to hate Ole Miss frat boys. And so it was tough for me to teach Ole Miss frat boys because that childhood hate actually was still there to some degree. And, you know, they're fairly degenerate tribe to begin with and not ideal students. So I failed as a teacher here and quit. I wasn't fired like Lou was fired. I quit and took a job driving a cab, and all my friends thought I was insane. But in the end, it seems to have paid off.
You know, when Lou goes off on, you know, cab drivers and the London cab drivers who do that test, the most difficult test in the world, the knowledge.
Yeah.
So I was in London and I was driving in a cab, and some Uber driver next to the cab driver rolls down his window and says, you know, how do you get to whatever? And the cab driver looks at him and he gives him that look that Jay's gives Lou. You know, it's like, and he basically, he just goes, fuck you, through the window. And then he turns to me and he goes, these fucking assholes, you know, he's not going to tell him how to get anywhere. The knowledge is better than a GPS.
It is supposed to be the most difficult test administered on planet Earth, is what they say. People study for it for years, but I guess once you pass it, you're set for life to some extent. I definitely tried to train myself using some of the methods they did there in London, because I really was worried about being unemployable at this point in my life. I had been fired from a number of jobs, bartending, and I wanted to excel at this job. And I did a lot of memory tests, used a lot of memory techniques that go all the way back to the Elizabethans in order to memorize shortcuts, routes, the location of every store and business in town. And it works, you know? It was kind of fun to be connected with the history to that extent, the history of, you know, memory palaces, memory systems, which have fallen out of use.
Yeah.
And they you really used to define intellect and defined the peak of the human mind, I think, in the Renaissance. And it's just something we don't use anymore, that nobody's even heard of a memory palace before. But they were fundamental to the Renaissance, and they were fundamental to human endeavor until the invention of the printing press, at which point memory palaces were bygone forever, I guess.
I know. It's like when you're in a cab in New York now and you ask the cab driver to take you to the Met or Penn Station, they don't seem like they know where it is. And, or an Uber driver doesn't know where anything is because he's looking at his GPS and I'm telling him, no, don't go that way. It's not going to work. And it's like, no, they never know where you're going ever.
And
Uber is kind of, you know, not a gigantic driver in the book, but yeah, it's like, how do cab drivers feel about Uber? It's just, you know, horrible.
Yeah, in the book, I would say Uber is just kind of a looming force of evil that is coming into the town. It's not there yet.
Right.
And Lou is not even clear what it is, but he knows it's going to end his job very likely, as all the other cabbies know that. And in fact, both cab companies I drove for are now out of business because of Uber. A few cab companies have survived, very small ones. But I think typically they go in and they eliminate 20-25% of the cab companies from any given town.
In New York, they have a little app now called Curb, where you can do the same thing and pay before the drive. But they're not going to catch up. It's not going to catch up to Uber.
Yeah, I figure the app must be, I mean, the app is remarkable. I've driven Uber, unfortunately. And in fact, I wouldn't have written the book if it hadn't been for Uber, because Uber allowed me to create time slots where I could write into my day. Without that, I could not have written the book. And I didn't start writing it until I quit my second cab company and started driving for Uber.
That reminds me, like, you know, again, selling your book and having the bookstore. I always like to talk about the cover and the epigraphs and the title. But before we do that, the title, The Last Taxi Driver, it comes from Lou within the book when he's talking to Moondog.
Yeah.
And there's this character, so Moondog, you can tell about him, but he's a really cool character because, again, it's the juxtaposition. He's painting these beautiful paintings and he's read Lou's book and the watermelon and all that, but he needs a type. You go ahead and tell. I can't tell. I'm not supposed to tell a book. You tell it.
Well, I mean, Moondog is an experienced cab driver who Lou perceives as a thug, an idiot, a biker. You know, and Lou has a low opinion of Moondog. They haven't got along. But then he does a pickup at Lou's at Moondog's house, and he sees that Moondog is a reader, a painter, and is a full-fledged human being in many levels, which is shocking to Lou. But again, it goes back to one of the themes of the book, which is redemption. And hopefully Moondog gets a little redemption in the book. There was a cabbie I worked with named Moondog. So that's where I have no imagination. I just stole the name. They look and act nothing alike. So I hope I don't think I'll be sued. But of course, in America, you're always worried about being sued.
Yeah. What? Did Moondog, the real Moondog, have hair plugs? Because I couldn't quite
understand. No, I thought that made me safe. Yeah, the hair plugs, I thought, now I can't get sued.
Well, yeah, it's like, I guess it's like Stella. Was Stella, did you have a Stella? Has she read the book?
I'm sorry, you're not coming in right now. Yeah, Stella exists. You know, I had a boss similar to Stella, but also very different. You know, I think, well, at least when I start writing, I'll start from life and then layer, so many drafts that by the time I'm finished, it's not the same person I started writing about. It's usually a hybrid between two or three, sometimes more people I know crammed into every character. With Stella, there was a lot of the real Stella, but there's some other people in her character, which I feel is important to say legally. But she really doesn't appear much in the book itself, but a voice on the telephone, I think.
Yeah. Have any of these people actually read the book?
To my knowledge, I've heard from two of the cab drivers I worked with. And they both called me up and was like, hey, you remember me? And you know, my heart stops and I think, oh, here we go. And then they said, like the book, love the book. And yeah, just very relieved and gratified to hear that. I've run into a bunch of ex-cab drivers who have read it and heard back from them. So it's always nice to get compliments from cabbies.
Yeah.
Even though my cab experience was so eccentric that it's hard to imagine they had much in common with a better run organization.
Well, so talking about show both covers so they can see, because I sell both the hardback and the...
Okay, yeah. Well, this is the new paperback.
Oh, okay.
You know, with the armadillo on the unicycle, you got to love that. And even people at Tin House, my publisher, like, we don't really understand this cover either, but intuitively we like it. And I did a word search and the word armadillo is used in the book once. So it probably isn't deserving, but I love it. I've always been fond of armadillos. And the other book, one second, the hardback.
Yep.
is the typical air freshener, which actually plays no part in my book. I deal with air fresheners a lot, but not the tree one that is the iconic one. But they used it because it's the only one you can put on a book and people know what it is. You know,
yeah,
air freshener.
That's true to a certain extent, but everybody in the book seems to know the Bigfoot one. I mean, they all say, but they all say, oh, you got the Bigfoot. How? I don't know what the hell the Bigfoot is. How do they all know what it is?
Everybody knows it. Really?
No, they don't.
You don't see this?
I
immediately think Bigfoot?
I think Bigfoot, but I mean, I don't think people are like conversing with the idea of Bigfoot being, so they're just recognizing Bigfoot. They're not recognizing Bigfoot as like this archetypical air freshener, right?
They recognize it and they latch onto it, which is always curious to me why everyone was so fond of the Bigfoot, because I'm not a Bigfoot guy myself. That's another way I differ from Lou.
Yeah, good
my
move.
My theory is no bones, no Bigfoot, right? If there was Bigfoot, we would have found the bones by now. Unless he's an extraterrestrial, which, okay. But so Lou's distressed that nobody notices his flying saucer, which I think is his favorite one. And nobody recognizes the Shakespeare one, Shakespearement. But yeah, Bigfoot gets all the publicity, all the limelight.
Well, the Zeta Reticulons are now, I watched on 60 Minutes, now UFOs are now in, and those guys are the guys that are in Roswell. I mean, it looks just like them.
Yeah, the Zeta Reticulans, very good. I came back from New Orleans 2 days ago. We were driving fast, speeding. My friend and I had been there for a week. We wanted to get back in time for the 60 Minutes episode on UFOs the other night. I've been a UFO freak all my life. So to me, it's fascinating. And I'm just trying to figure out why now? Why are they starting to tell us aspects of the truth now after really 80 years of life?
I know why. It's because all these cool guys like commanders and pilots with 6,000 hours of flight time, they've seen this, but they've been scared to report it. Now they're coming forward. Anderson Cooper last night, they had a woman, really nice looking woman, who was, I guess I shouldn't say that either, cancel culture. But anyway, she was a pilot, and she was saying, I'm doing this because I want my peers to be able to come forward and not be scared they're going to lose their job. I saw a UFO when I was a kid, but I was like 10 years old, and I told my parents and they told me I was an idiot, but I did see one, but I don't know what it was. Have you ever seen one?
Yeah, I've been plagued with seeing them my whole life and I have no idea why. Lucky for me, I've always been with other people who are considered more reliable than me and they've seen it as well. But they've been encounters where the ship actually veers towards you or reacts to you. The sighting described in the book is verbatim with two of my friends. I was actually standing up through the moonroof of my friend Randy's car while the triangle craft went directly overhead. And it was nice and amazing. It wasn't scary at all. Other ones I've seen have been more sinister looking. I've seen another black triangle driving home from my bartending job in Vermont. There's a lot of UFOs in Vermont for some reason. And I don't understand why I keep seeing them, but I enjoy it. I like that aspect of it. I think it's kind of magical and playful. I don't think I'm being abducted or anything like that, but perhaps we'll find out more in the coming month when that report is finally released.
Yeah.
And hopefully they're gonna tell us the truth, but I don't trust anything about UFO disclosure.
Well, it's like, that's the other problem with your book. It's like the same thing is true. Anything you hear, that's the problem. Whether it's CNN or Fox, either side, none of it's true. And that's just what they're selling. Was your head outside the moonroof before you saw the UFO?
No.
Because I did that.
We spotted it way ahead. My friend Randy said, what's that? He was driving. And there was this weird, bright, white light way off in the distance. And he said, I've been watching that thing for 20 minutes and we're not getting any closer to it. And so we all started watching it. and we watched it for another 15 minutes. And then suddenly we did start getting closer to it. It started coming towards us. And it was still this white, nebulous call of light that seemed very contained. And it wasn't until it passed directly over our heads that we saw the triangle craft underneath this cloud of light.
That's what mine looked like.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, it was a triangle. And I didn't think it was supposed to be a triangle. I thought it was supposed to be a saucer. And
Yes. The triangle ones have an interesting history in that there's been a rumor forever that they were created by Lockheed Martin with the Pentagon and that they're actually ours.
Right.
You know, I'm skeptical about that, as I am about everything about UFOs. If they tell you one thing, the opposite is probably true. The triangle ones are supposed to be ours, but a lot of information coming out now with this new disclosure seems to indicate that the triangle ones are not ours. So hopefully more information will come out, but it's going to come slowly, if at all.
I had my head over out the moonroof of a car one time, but it was because I was in an altered state of consciousness and it almost had fatal consequences.
It was a wonderful experience for me because I had the best view in the world of that UFO and really could have hit it with a slingshot. And it passed overhead. It wasn't going particularly fast. And, you know, I couldn't perceive any noise, but we're in a vehicle moving forward. So it could have made some noise. I wouldn't have heard it. But right as it passed overhead, then it did some sort of transformation thing that it made no sense to my eyes. And suddenly it looked like a different vehicle in some ways than it had moments earlier. And I can make no sense of that and still can make no sense of that, but I saw it very clearly. And it almost morphed, which would indicate it's probably not from Lockheed Martin or the Pentagon.
Let's go back to selling your book.
Yeah.
So, I'm kind of pissed off at you because Ode to Billy Joe has been stuck in my head for two fucking days. And that's all your fault. So
at least it's a decent song.
Yeah, I know. So do you think that you think she threw the baby off? I mean, but the thing, is that what you think it is? That off the bridge?
The baby had been born already and thrown off?
I don't know, but everyone knew if everyone knew she was pregnant, that's not what it would be because she would get caught.
It's a mystery. I don't think we're supposed to know.
Well, don't you have a theory? You have theories on UFOs.
Crazy, not crazy. Maybe Billy Joe was pushed. You know, maybe she pushed him. I don't know. But it's got to be something to do with a pregnancy. I mean, they were throwing flowers together over the bridge, right?
Yeah.
Or was she just throwing flowers at the very end?
She was throwing flowers. She would go up there from time to time, throw the flowers off in memoriam. But the thing is, they would know she was pregnant. And the other thing that's cool about that is, and it's a gnomon for the entire book, is the fact that he likes pass the biscuits, please. Because it's so perfect, because it has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song, beautiful songwriting. And it's not a bad song to have stuck in your head. When I was in New Orleans, I had Cher's Half-Breed stuck in my head for 2 days.
No, that's
I almost bad. Lost my mind with it. So,
well, that's the other thing. He listens to like interesting music because he listens to Beethoven, who I love. He listens to David Banner, who I hate, and Mose Allison, who's incredibly good. But he runs the gamut, just like he does intellectually too. These people are not who you expect them to be. And that's always good because, like you were saying before, you look at someone and you think he's someone, he's not that person at all.
Yeah. The music, with the exception of Beethoven, I think, is all rises around the area where Lou drives, you know, that ship from Memphis to Oxford or Gentry, that, you know, and that's the heartland of American music. And so I tried to include all Mississippi and a few Memphis artists in Lou's playlist. But, you know, I wanted to use lyrics, but that's a very difficult and expensive endeavor if you want to quote lyrics. So I'm really bitter about that. The fact that writers can't quote two lines from a song without paying $1,000, you know.
And plus, Plus, you got to go through contacting everybody too, which is a royal pain in the butt. I don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
That's got to be hard. Well, what about the epigraph from Peter Boyle out of Taxi Driver? Did you have to vet that or did you just stick
it? No, it's just music.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. And I don't understand why. And I'm glad the musicians are getting some money, but a friend of mine had to pay the Rolling Stones $2,000 to quote them. And the Rolling Stones don't need that money. And my friend's poor, you know, and
I must make a fortune. Geez. And then but it's nice when you see like Aha get a commercial because you figure they must be broke by now. So if they get a car commercial, it's like, I feel happy for them because they're making some money.
If they need the money, that's perfect.
They'll need it.
I think Lou is a little critical, as is Bill Hicks, about our tendency to peddle things, you know, when you don't have to. I think he uses the example of Jay Leno selling Doritos.
I was just going to say that. I don't like Jay Leno anyway, but.
Right. That's why. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's like with Bill Hicks, you know, he is the epigraph, too. And then he's also runs through the book. But, and he's always been, this is totally off the wall, but George Saunders has always been called like a writer's writer. And mm-hmm. Bill Hicks is like a comedian's comedian, right?
Yeah.
And that's interesting, isn't it?
It's a little bit hard to pin that down, what that means, but I know. Instinctively agree with it. I think Bill Hicks had a lot more influence on other comedians than he did audience while alive, perhaps. I still haven't gone by his grave. I could have gone by on this trip to New Orleans, but we were running late and had to make the 60-minute episode. But we did stop by the Lynyrd Skynyrd crash site in Macomb.
Oh, and yeah, that's yeah.
Very tasteful. Well done. Amazingly well done. And I'm trying to figure out whose idea was this? Who put up the money? Why? It's in the middle of nowhere. There's no commercialism attached to it. There's no gift shop. There's just this really tasteful and expensive memorial out in the middle of Macomb County. Somebody cared enough to do it. It was very nicely done.
I saw Lynyrd Skynyrd like 20 years ago, and they were already old, and they were wearing like, sometimes fat people will wear like a tie-dye t-shirt with like leggings underneath. They think it makes them look better, svelte. So anyway, I was kind of pissed, but then when they did Freebird, and all four guitars come walking up to the front, it still gave you that feeling.
Yeah.
But there wasn't, it's not the original cast, so.
Oh, it's one of the remakes. Yeah.
No, it wasn't like a tribute band, it was them.
The Survivors, or was Ronnie with them when you saw them? Was it pre-rec or post-rec?
Oh, it was way post-rec.
Okay, yeah. The thing about Lynyrd Skynyrd is they're easy to stereotype, and of course they stereotype themselves. But then you pay attention and you realize how good they are. You know, they can play their instruments. And apparently Ronnie Van Zant was just it's not right to use this word, but I want to say he had a very, they said he was like a Nazi. He was making them practice, beating them up if they didn't practice enough. He bullied them in becoming a brilliant band. And it worked.
Yeah, it's like Dwayne Allman. I mean, he made the Allman Brothers. I never really liked Greg that much. But yeah, Dwayne Allman and, you know, Derek and the Dominoes and playing the lead on songs that Eric would give him, you know? Yeah. He was an amazing guitarist.
I mean, Rosington and Collins were incredible guitar players and the band was about playing the guitar. But I guess Ronnie Van Zant, who was not a great vocalist, but was good for the type of music he was writing and playing, kept it all together. And yeah, so I listened to them yesterday after going to the memorial and I had like tears coming down my eyes. Music has that effect, right? It's strange.
Yeah, and I was living in Gainesville then, Gainesville, Florida, and they were from Jacksonville.
Right.
And their football coach, Lynyrd Skynyrd. Yeah, that was a big deal. I mean, they were like my contemporaries then.
Yeah, I tell people they're like my Beatles growing up, you know.
You really are a Southerner. Oh, yeah. And that reminds me of Lou defining who's a Mississippian and who isn't, which is kind of horrible because he's insulting you.
Well, Lou's bitter about a lot of things. And luckily, I'm not bitter about anything. But yes, Lou, he was upset with all the academic MFA, AWP, creative writing program people in town. And let's face it, that's there's 40 writers in this town. They did a group photo recently.
Really?
Attached to the MFA world, creative writing program world. And it's Lou's bitter about that because let's face it, Oxford's two most famous writers, postal clerk and a firefighter, you know, Faulkner, Larry Brown. But now we're swarmed with academic writers. And these are people who have very few of them. They seem they're too wealthy to be writers. They live in their houses are beautiful and they've been in academic programs their whole lives. They don't have working experience. Many of them don't. And this is where American letters has gone during my lifetime. It's been overtaken by these AWP MFA programs.
And yeah, it's like half the authors I interview have gotten their MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop. And I don't know why the Iowa Writers Workshop is like the preempt. It's in Iowa, for God's sakes. You know?
It was the first. I mean, it was the first one. I think the University of Arkansas was the second. And there used to be, when I grew up, there were maybe five programs in the whole country. And that was actually very good for American literature. But to have 500 programs is the inevitable death of literature in America. Writers without experience is not what you want. And writers no longer have the back of poor people. Writers have always been associated with poverty. They've always had the back of poor people. And now we have the school of writers who have really, they haven't been poor. They don't share the same concerns as the people they're writing about. My friend Randy Yates owns Ajax Diner, which is the most popular diner in Oxford. And he was great friends with Larry Brown, et cetera, has known every writer. And I asked him what he thought about the creative writing program. And he's paused for a moment, then he said, rich people writing about poor people.
Yeah.
And there it is right there. That's what they do.
Well, that's why, you know, poor people. Like you have Eric Hoffer, who wrote some of the best books on philosophy. He was a longshoreman. I mean, that's the idea. Or Kafka or Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, you know, Kafka wasn't really happy when he wrote Metamorphosis in one night. I mean, shit.
You know what I mean? I don't think he was very happy in general.
No, he wasn't. He was sick and he was unhappy. And
wanted all his books burned too, I think. He wanted all of his work destroyed.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. Yeah. You have a last wish. He tells Max Brod, burn everything. And then Max Brod violates his best friend's last wish. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the trial or the cast. So I always wondered, okay, which is better? I mean, he violated the wish, but now we have this incredible wealth of material.
I think it was a good move.
But yeah, I think so too. All right, we're still not selling the damn book.
No.
So, well, other than people thinking you're kind of whacked and the book's whacked, so it means, okay. And me, they think I'm an idiot. So anyway, so I feel sorry for Anna in the book because she's got to wait a long time. I mean, she's waiting a really long time, but at least she's at the bookstore.
Yeah, Anna's the elderly regular customer of Lou's, who he's very protective of. And she gets stranded during this shift from hell. Lou's experiencing like the worst day of his life.
Yeah.
And he simply cannot pick her up from the doctor's office. And because Stella has no interest in picking her up. And, you know, once again, she's based on a customer of mine to a degree and somebody I was very fond of. And, you know, she would, I would lend her books and we would talk about books every day when I drove her around. And I was her access to the outside world. And again, that's day shift cab driving. People who have no outlet to the world have cab drivers take them places. And there's an intimate relationship there because their world is so closed and lonely in a lot of ways. And that's something else I really enjoyed about driving during the day.
Yeah, it's like your dedication to people in the service industry. I mean, whether a woman is styling your hair or whether it's someone who's your dental hygienist, they have a good thing because you can't talk back to them. But these people are your therapists. And for Anna, that's what that's what Lou is. It's like, you know, you have the therapy session. It's really nice because it doesn't cost any money and usually it's good advice.
Yeah. I was always aware as a cab driver that people in the back seat, generally in the back seat more than the front seat, seemed to be performing, especially if there was two or three of them back there. It was almost like a little one-act play. You would understand they were performing for me, the driver. And sometimes that was very cool, nice. And other times, like with racist frat boys, it was horrendous because they couldn't wait to trot out the N-word because they just project their racism onto a cab driver. It never crosses their mind that their cab driver isn't also a racist. So that was a very bad thing about the job was I was driving when Trump was becoming popular and during the primary and the general, and the frat boys I picked up just could not wait to use the N-word in front of me. They would yell it out the window. And for a while I would kick them out, but that was costly and dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
And eventually you just strangle the steering wheel and keep driving. It's your job to listen to them run their mouths. I had no idea so much racism still existed in the Greek system at Ole Miss, but it does, unfortunately. Those places, the college fraternities, are a safe haven, if nothing else, for racism. You have these kids who come up with through private academies in high school, so they never go to school with people of color. All through high school, they go to seg education academies, we call them. And then they go straight from there into the segregated Greek fraternity system at Ole Miss. So they've never been around people of color. And so they still believe the lies of racism that their grandfather raised them on. Racism here is generational, and integration is now almost forgotten and gone, unfortunately. But integration is the only way I think Mississippi can conquer racism.
Yeah, it's like the NAACP says, they have a book that says, do not travel to Mississippi. It's like saying, don't travel to Laos. You know, it's like, it's horrible. Which reminds me of, in that intellectual interview you did, the one thing that I really found poignant was when you talked about the chapter that you were worried about and how Tin House came to your, was supporting you. Talk a little bit about that, a little bit.
Well, there was one chapter when Lou has a flashback and relives his childhood in integrated school system, public school system, in which Lou was the skinniest white kid in the school system, and he's a minority. And his life is tough. He's getting beat up by black kids every day. And there was also a rape described in the book that's pretty pivotal to the plot that he had to endure. And that made everybody uncomfortable because here, while the Black Lives Matter protests were going on, et cetera, was this book showing a black kid, showing a white kid being terribly abused by black kids in the school system. And that ran counter to the public narrative at that point. And so it did make people nervous. It made me nervous, but it was my experience with the school system. And I'm a big proponent of integration. I believe in it fiercely, but in Mississippi, it was designed to fail. It was underfunded. They did not want it to work. It didn't work. And it was a disaster. And it was terrifying to me. Every day I was beat up so many times. And I think you have a right to write about your own experiences. And Tin House was great about that whole part. And, you know, we did edit a few things out to make it a little bit more palatable. But I'm grateful to them for the editing. Tony Perez was my editor, and he did a great job.
Yeah. It's more of that cancel culture stuff. But I'll tell you an interesting thing. I mean, my bookstore is outside of Philadelphia, and it's one of the highest socioeconomic demographics in the area. And I put a Black Lives Matter sign in my window. And that's all I did. I got death threats. I got messages on my phone and letters saying, we love your bookstore, but unfortunately we will no longer be able to frequent it. You know, like the Karen thing. And I'm going, well, fuck you. I don't give a shit if you come in. I mean, I'm not gonna make any money in this bookstore anyway, so I could care less. But I was surprised where I am that that was still something. I just, you know, I'm thinking, oh, this doesn't exist up here.
I think the whole, as a nation, we were all surprised. We thought, we knew racism was a problem, but let's face it, most of us didn't understand the degree to which it was a problem.
Well, I did think it was a problem in Mississippi, but I didn't think it was a problem in a suburb of Philadelphia until I realized that everyone around me had, I didn't see any Biden signs on the grass, just Trump signs. And I still see, you know, impeached number 46, you know, stuff like that. It's just dumb shit.
Oh, yeah. I saw a big flag yesterday driving home. I said, Biden is not my president.
Right. Yeah. Stop the steal. It's worrisome because, well, I always say we're doomed. That's my credo in life is we're doomed.
Like George Saunders told you. Yes.
Yeah. It really bothers me. I mean, I've been doing it so long that people, I don't have any friends anyway, but if I did, I wouldn't. But, okay, back to the book again. So talk about Stanford, because he fits into that, kind of into that realm. Did I get his name wrong? Stanford? The rich guy that he beat up at the bar.
Oh, that guy? Yeah, you know, you have to change the names of characters so many times in the course of publishing that I sometimes have the wrong names for the characters. He was not a big part of the book, but he was kind of an example of the Ole Miss frat boy at its worst. Grown up, he's going to inherit a private prison. So he's a very beat-upable character. And I don't know, I don't think there was much redemption for him in the book. He might have been one of the few characters.
He did say no hard feelings. That was interesting. It was like when Lou in that chapter like kind of slapped a hand, and then that black guy was his protector for 6 months.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like that, where in this case Lou doesn't really say, yeah, no hard feelings, but yeah, the guy does. So, you know.
Yeah, and Lou's not a violent guy. He's not a bully. You know, he's terrified of guns. He's not a typical Southern male character, I don't think, by any means.
Yeah. He's an
anomaly. It's like the only fight he's ever won in his life, he says.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, I was always worried about headbutting, because I figure if you're butting someone's head, then your head's going to get hurt as bad as the guy whose head you're butting.
You would think so, right?
Yeah. But
I played soccer starting at the age of 40 for every week, just for a decade and a half. And the one thing I was good at was heading the ball.
I have that
in my repertoire now. You know, any fight shows out, I'm going straight to the header, because nobody in America anticipates that.
No.
You know, in soccer, right?
No.
So it's just like having a superpower.
Yeah, it's like all my nephews are wrestlers. They all wrestled in high school. So if they get into fights, they just go down on the ankles and that's it. The fight's over, you know?
That would confuse most people. Yeah, that would get me. I think the shin kick is the other good move. Yeah, when you kick somebody in the shin, they're, for the next 5 minutes, they're going to be hopping around and stuff. So,
yeah, my youngest daughter, who's like, well, she's 20 now, all she does is kick them and she kicks. Well, I'm not going to say.
Yeah, well, that works too. But
yeah, well, she's going to get pissed off if she listens to this, but no one listens. Yeah.
You didn't use her name, so.
Yeah, I'm like you. Oh, the other ones, which must be classic. Well, even I've seen this, and maybe I've been this, is Teddy and Tiffany.
Teddy and Tiffany. Yeah. Well, they certainly weren't based on anybody real. Teddy is like a judge's son, rich, completely unemployable, chronic 24-hour-a-day alcoholic. And his really annoying girlfriend, who's trying to get him to marry her for his money. They're Lou's regulars, and they make his life miserable every day of his life. And like I said, they certainly weren't based on real people.
Yeah, they were a mess. Plus, she's going out with his best friend, and she's that term, what's the term you use when what she's doing to his neck? I had never heard that term before. Something sucking.
I'm sorry.
The term that you that Lou uses when Tiffany leans forward and is sucking his neck, you know, what's the name of that? Because I looked it up in the Urban Dictionary. Look it up in the Urban Dictionary because it's a really disgusting, really.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's really disgusting. I can't even.
Yeah, I don't recall the word myself, so
it's like,
I don't know.
It was like fish sucking or something like that, but yeah, look at look that term up. Really bad. So, well, have we gone through enough? This has been an hour. So
it is.
Yeah, 54 minutes and 27 seconds. Anyway, so I'm looking forward to the Shakespeare book because I don't know why you would be doing that, but it's like your UFO thing.
Right. It's very much like the UFO thing. Obsession. You know, I work obsession to obsession. I watched my son grow up doing that too. I think it's runs in my family. And one of my obsessions is for the last 20 years, I've been trying to find a lost portrait of Shakespeare and also trying to convince curators to X-ray and infrared their portraits said or rumored to be Shakespeare so that we can see beneath the paint into the original composition to see what, if anything, was censored out of the paint. Because you're looking at a 400-year-old painting, you're looking at overpaint. The real painting is underneath. So I became fascinated with getting portraits X-rayed and pretty good at talking curators into doing it. And that plays a big part in the book. But yeah, I wanted to find a portrait of Shakespeare painted from life. And that's never been found. Right now, the beautiful Cobb portrait.
Yeah.
You know, they're insinuating it was painted from life, but they don't know that. They don't even know that's Shakespeare. I noticed Shakespeare was getting more and more beautiful every decade. Every newly discovered portrait, suddenly he was handsome. You know, he was a Playboy pinup almost. So what I did was I went back and concentrated on all the candidate portraits from the past that were hideous and ugly, figuring that's the way to find Shakespeare, because the Droschut engraving from the First Folio of 1623 shows, you know, the guy with the bug eyes and the huge watermelon head, et cetera. So I concentrated on the uglier, neglected portraits of Shakespeare.
All right, this is the last thing I want to say about the book. The thing I liked a lot about Moondog too is the fact that he had this really crappy body, but his face looks like the Marlboro Man. And I always wanted to look like the Marlboro Man. But I don't want to have Moondog's body either. But that was a good one.
Thanks. Yeah. Moondog was a late addition to the book. So
you gave him a new head.
Yeah. Somebody told me I should write a scene like the Coen brothers.
Exactly.
What I did. I said, okay, I can.
Yeah. It's like Barton Fink.
Moondog was born of that.
All right. Well, so anyway, hopefully I can see you if you want to, like in the next 6-8 months when the Shakespeare book comes out. That would be great.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. This was great. It's a great book. And the good thing for you is that if people listen to this and they come to the bookstore and I can, and my daughter, again, she's a good hand seller. She comes out from behind the counter and she hits them over the head. You have to buy this book. And she's so... She's a fire plug. They buy it. She just does it.
Please tell her I said thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Anyway, Lee, pleasure talking to you. It's fun.
My pleasure at all. You were actually funnier than I was, which is a bit discouraging.
All right. That's a nice compliment. Thanks a lot. All right. Catch you later then.
Okay, bye-bye.
See ya.